Okay, so we'll get started. Last time we were looking at ways of increasing our bandwidth efficiency over sort of basic modulation techniques. And so we looked at spread spectrum, OFDM, and MIMO. And the idea of spread spectrum was to just that spread the signal over the frequency range and therefore combat frequency selective fading effects. So, you know, if it's a narrowband signal, you run the risk of it being sort of wiped out. You spread it over a range. Even if the portion is wiped out, hopefully we can recreate from what's left. Okay. And we saw that we could do that either by explicitly changing the carrier frequency on which a narrowband signal is sent, that's frequency hopping spread spectrum, or by increasing the bit rate at which we are transmitting our signal, and we do that by encoding a single bit into a number of bits. If you're using a sort of wider frequency range spectrum to transmit a signal, of course, you know, the next question becomes, well, if you have to, you know, have more than one user, how do you accommodate them? And the question is, you have to be clever about how you encode your bits or select your frequency hops. And so if we can do that in a way that's essentially orthogonal or near orthogonal, we can give everybody a different code and recover the information at the other end. Okay. So when choosing your coding sequences, we said they wanted, you know, we observed that you want them to be random. If you're sharing amongst multiple users, you want some orthogonality. And we looked at several methods of choosing those sequences. Now, we then moved on to OFDM. And OFDM eliminates this need for non-overlapping channels by choosing them so it's cleverly choosing the overlap. And the bottom line is it's going to give you better bandwidth efficiency than CDMA, and it's easier to allocate multiple channels, so it's easier to share out various sub-channels amongst users. And finally, it works well with MIMO techniques. And these MIMO techniques, in turn, are a way of dividing the bandwidth, you know, sort of a fixed channel into sub-channels that somehow we can distinguish. And again, these, well, I shouldn't say for OFDM, we can also share users. Originally, you might, we've pack these channels in, you might allocate them all to a single user, but we can also allocate subchannels to multiple users. Okay. Furthermore, MIMO is splitting those channels into subchannels, which are distinguished via multipath characteristics. And we can either use that to improve our signal, so to provide redundancy for our signal, or to increase throughput by sending two separate streams along the subchannel, or multiple separate streams along the subchannels. Okay. Naturally. So today, it's called Cellular Networks Basic Principles, and the big question we're asking today is how do we maintain connectivity with the network for users that are on the move, so for users that aren't going to be sort of attaching to a single access point and staying there. Okay. And okay. Most of the material is drawn from Stallings. Some of the sort of again increasing capacity techniques are, can be found in various cellular textbooks. So we're going to start with just a little overview of what the basic principle is. Look at an example. The example we look at is maintaining a call, but the same thing would sort of for a mobile user. Same thing would apply for mobile users trying to stream data, anything where, again, they need to maintain the connectivity as they move. Okay. We're going to look at how we arrange for sort of just full connectivity in the sense of how we just arrange our access points so that we don't have gaps. We're going to say a few words about power control. We already noted that previously when we talked about sort of maintaining quality. We'll now see again why that's sort of important in the context of having multiple access points or base stations. And then we'll look at some of the tricks for increasing our capacity over what the basic setup gives us. Okay. So, well, everybody knows what a cellular network does. Again, it provides large-scale coverage. Most of the country is covered, so, you know, if you wanted to drive along having a chat from here to Cork, there's at least a reasonable chance you can do that. It accomplishes this, obviously, by providing a sequence of connections, not just a single connection. Okay. So we have to reuse our spectrum from one connection to the next Obviously, you can't just keep dedicated spectrum over a wider and wider area. Okay. So the need for the multiple access points arises because of the characteristic of wireless networks or wireless signals that they have a limited range. And we've assumed this exponential decrease of power with distance. But conversely, if you make the distance sufficient, then the two signals will not interfere with each other. So it's think of having the same carrier frequency. That will only allow you to travel so far from an access point, but somebody sort of at a far distance could use that same carrier frequency and it wouldn't be interfering with your communication. Okay. So this leads to the cellular structure. Each cell is defined as a region in which a certain channel or set of channels is used. Each cell is served by a base station. You won't use the same channels in adjacent cells. and that would cause interference. Ideally, what we'd like is everything to be regular. Okay, so every of the base stations are placed equidistant to each other. Okay, obviously, in reality, we may not be able to achieve that, but you know, we'll be looking at this idealized case where everything sort of arrange everything quite regularly. Okay. So again, mobility is going to require connectivity from base station to base station to base station as you travel through cells, and that's going to require a change of channel or frequency as you travel through cells. Okay. Now, in cellular networks, these cells are then going to connect back in the first case, a mobile switching center, and then from there back into a fixed wired network. And the mobile switching center then is going to be responsible for typically governing, managing the cells within its region. Okay. So topics for today are going to be frequency reuse. So how are we going to, we assume if we have a spectrum, we have a certain number of channels. How do we divvy up those channels amongst ourselves? And how do we reuse the channels amongst the cells? Okay. And that's what we're going to see is that that's pretty much it's a geometric exercise, and it's going to be dependent on the required level or the acceptable level of interference from adjacent cell or from cells using the same channels. Just for completeness, we'll say a few words about power management within cells. Our basic assumption, initially anyway, is that at least the base stations are transmitting at the same power level. We'll then have a look at some basic traffic engineering results. So given a certain number of channels within the cell, how much traffic or how many users can be supported? This is one of the Erlang's results, or the master students have seen this in a lot greater depth, possibly in other modules. We're just going to use the results here and have a look at them. They are somewhat complicated by mobility, so it's not quite an ideal fit, but again, we're just going to get the basic flavor of how you would study the question. And again, then we're going to look at some tricks and some changes to our basic model that will allow for better capacity. Okay, so we'll start with a simple example of, how a cellular network would view this issue of connectivity. And so in particular, we're going to look at the question of how would you set up a call and maintain a call, excuse me, over this cellular network. In particular, we're going to look at the mobile-to-mobile call. Okay. And so the main components we're looking at are the end users, which we're calling mobile units, the base stations to which the mobile units are going to connect wirelessly, and then some sort of mobile switching center, or which will manage the base unit, the base stations, and also connect to the user back into the public networks, either an internet or the telephone network. Okay. So, again, if we have one mobile trying to call another mobile, and we're assuming they're more or less in the same locality here, then first, the calling mobile is going to have to try and connect into the system, and there will be the base station will send signals, maintenance signals, and which will allow the mobile user to determine which base station are they closest to, or which base station do they have the best connection to. Okay. They can then ask for a connection, essentially make the call, and that this kind of request would get forwarded back to our MSC or MDSO, as we're calling it now, which then has the task of trying to find the callee, the receiver. Okay. Typically, it has an idea of a basic region that the callee is in, but that region will consist of multiple base stations, so it has to page those base stations to find the actual page the calling the thing of those base stations to find the calling. Okay. If the calling then accepts the call, that information is again cycled back through the MTSO, and a connection is made out. We won't worry about sort of the back end of that connection, but what we will think of is that both of these end users are receiving an ongoing connection, even if they're moving. Okay. If they are moving, then it's going to be the responsibility of the cellular network to hand them off from one base station to the next without losing that connection. Okay. Yeah, so again, this is just a little more detail on all of those different steps. So you start with the mobile unit sort of registering itself with the network. It determines which base station to connect to by monitoring specific control channels and picking, again, the best signal it can get, and then registering the user. So, performing some authorization and having its location then registered within the network. Okay. If it tries to make a call, then again, it has to request that connection over a control channel. That channel is open to multiple users to be using, so it has to wait until it's available. And when it has made that request, the request is forwarded to the MPSO, who then has to look for the call. And so it's going to, it will have, assuming that the callee is connected to the network, again, it's active within the network, it will have some number. It will know sort of a basic area in which the callee is, and it will have to ask a number of base stations for the exact location of the callee. The base station that locates the callee then forwards the call request to the callee, and which one the callee would be, so yes or no. If yes, then the set up a connection using some currently unused channel in the cell, and which is allocated by the next station. So as long as the caller and callee remain within their original cell, well, that's fine, nothing changes. But as we said, we have to keep it for mobility now. So the final piece of the puzzle is handover. So if the mobile is moving out of the range of one base station and into another, then then it has to be connected to the new base station. So there's a lot of different ways of determining when that handover should occur. The decision can be made by the base station alone, or with feedback from the end user. And so both the connectivity with the end user is going to be taken into account, and possibly also the congestion in the current cell. So if a user is in a cell where a lot of the channels are in use, most of the channels or all of the channels are in use, again, the base station is going to be keen to try and shift off any of the traffic that it can. Relative to the quality of the user signal, well, the first cut would be, well, you probably want to take the strongest signal. The problem with that is, think about a unit that's moving sort of perpendicular to a line between two base stations, so it's moving between two base stations. Then which signal is stronger, there's not going to be much of a difference, so it's likely to bounce back and forth, and you don't want, in that case, to be handing over, all the time. Okay. So, either strongest signal plus threshold or strongest signal with hysteresis, try to avoid that condition. Strongest signal plus threshold says only change if your current signal is becoming essentially too weak, so it's dropping below a threshold. And so again, if both signals are relatively the same, they're probably it's going to stick with whatever its current connection is. And and then strong signal with hysteresis, you change it into new signal, stronger by a certain amount. Okay, so again, if they're bouncing along relatively similar signal strengths, you're not going to change. And of course, you can do a combination of that. Additionally, you can try and do some prediction. So you can decide, is your user moving away from a base station? Is it moving towards a base station, etc.? Okay, so you want to be thinking about changing again if it's moving towards one station and away from another. Okay. So, the first question we're going to ask today is just how do we arrange our base stations so that we get sufficient, our base stations and, of course, the set of channels that each station can use so that we get a sufficient degree of insulation from one base station to the next, and sort of a lower, an upper bound on the amount of interference from one station to the next. Okay. So again, that's going to rely on this property that our signal is dropping as some exponential of the distance. Again, this is our large-scale fading effects, and this is the only effect we're going to consider for this lecture. And we're going to assume that everything in our system is nice and regular. So all of our base stations are going to transmit at equal power. And we're out in a nice flat field somewhere, so the power is going to decrease uniformly for all base stations. So we can reuse our channels, our frequencies, if the base stations are sufficiently far apart from each other. Okay. Because, again, you're within a cell, your power is going to be sort of above a certain level, and then, again, the interference is governed by this drop, and so, the farther away you move a base station using the same frequencies, the less interference it will contribute. There will be some interference, and that's referred to as co-channel interference. So the goal is going to be to, again, arrange all these things so that this co-channel interference stays at an acceptable level. Okay. And so we're going to look at two techniques. We're really only looking at one. We're really considering our binaural systems. Okay, so here we've divided our channels up into distinct carrier frequencies, and each channel and the channels do not interfere with each other. Okay. Obviously, the alternative is like a CDMA technique, where you're using same frequencies, using the whole spectrum in each cell and distinguishing through your coding techniques. Okay. We're addressing these autonomous systems, mainly in all these dimensions. Again, as we go along, how CDMA differs. Okay. So again, the goal is to interfere, to limit the interference from multiple base stations' signals with each other. Okay. And the amount, degree of interference is going to be captured in what's called the signal to interference ratio. Okay. And so for our orthogonal systems, that's caused by different cells using the same channel or same frequency. And it's going to be managed by finding some minimum distance for the leaves of the channels. Again, for CDMA, you're using all of the frequencies or whole spectrum in each cell. And so interference actually comes internally, depending on the coding, and from adjacent cells. In addition to the signal to interference ratio, do keep in mind that we also have noise present in the system, but noise will be dealt with in the actual signal power at a level great enough to compensate for the noise. Okay. So whenever anybody mentions cellular systems, you see this sort of honeycomb layout. Hexagons, and so the basic idea is that you take a cluster of these cells and you divide out the channels amongst the cells in the cluster. So within this cluster, the whole spectrum will be used, but in any given cell, or in the countries, it's 717 in that spectrum. You then repeat that pattern again and again and again. And so if you look at this specific example, you see that adjacent cells are not going to use the same channels. Out, and there's a certain distance between base stations that do use channels. And so what we're going to do is, again, we're going to say, we're going to define how much interference between cells will tolerate. That is going to define how far away from each other we have to put our cells, and that in turn will lead to a geometric exercise which tells us how many cells we have to put in our cluster in order to sufficiently insulate our and any given cell from interference. This hexagonal layout is quite a common layout, and it works well if you think of our signals as being essentially circular. A second common layout is square or diamond shape. And again, this is something that was pointed out for the American style cities where you have a grid-like street system and you're putting antennas on sort of on street corners or on buildings. So, again, this is an ideal. Actual layouts obviously are going to be dependent on issues such as planning and terrain and sort of and things like that. Okay. In our ideal world, we want for our cell shape and indeed our cell clusters is that what they are, what's called tessellated, and that means that they can be arranged to cover an entire area with no overlap. Okay, so you can see how per square to slide them, take them one side to the next to the next. They're not overlapping anymore, missing any coverage, and again, the same thing for a hexagon. The actual coverage, obviously, then is not circular. Okay. In practice, you're going to have to limit your cell size to limit the power, the transmit power. And again, this is particularly important on the mobile side. I actually noticed this summer. I was driving through sort of the wilds of the U.S. and my battery was running down incredibly quickly because it was longer distances between base stations. I was having to transmit at a higher power. Okay. So as I said, this ideal that we're looking at is just that. Ideal, but it does give us some idea of the basic principles. Typically, there's a lot of work that goes into determining the site of any new base station and then its power and coverage area. Okay, so back to the ideal world. We have a certain spectrum that we divide up into these orthogonal channels that aren't interfering with each other. And so then we want to allocate those channels within the cells. And what we do is we define cell clusters. And we allocate the entire spectrum within that cluster. Okay. We then, again, repeat, and we define the clusters again so that we're able to repeat. We have then allocated all channels. The question then becomes, are cells using the same channel sufficiently far away from each other? Okay. The definition of sufficiently far away is what's called the reuse distance, and that is the minimum distance between cells using the same channels. Okay. The reuse distance is going to be determined by, again, looking at what the signal to interference ratio is for our system. Okay, the required signal to interference ratio. Okay. So, it actually becomes a bit of a geometric exercise. We'll start by looking at diamonds, again, because it's easier to look at, and say that we've allocated all of our channels. We can define our reuse distance in terms of the size of our cell. So we give the distance from the center to the edge from R, and the number of cells we have to traverse to get to the next. So the distance, again, you have a number of interfering cells, that's Ni, and then you have an R and an R, 2R, so 1 times 2R. So again, that's straightforward enough. We'd like to do something similar for our hexagonal cells. The problem is that if we look between any cell and any other cell, we aren't sort of traversing our intervening cells in any sort of regular fashion. So what we do is we try and regularize that by changing our coordinates. So instead of moving sort of as the crow flies directly, we are going to look at moving from center to center to center. Okay. And so there are basically two directions we can go. There's the u-axis giving us an up-down direction, and then the v-axis, which is giving us this sort of more diagonal direction. Okay. So again, if we wanted to get from N to G in a regular fashion, we go through O and then up. Okay. So what's this going to do for us? Again, it's going to let us express eventually the distance between any two centers as a function of the size of the cell and how many cells we're traversing. So again, looking at our coordinate system, our center is at A, so A would be 0, 0. G, we're going 0 in the U direction, 1 in the V direction. S, you're going 1 in the U direction, 1 in the V direction. P, you're going minus 2 in the U direction and 2 in the V direction. And M, you're going minus 1 in the U direction, minus 1 in the V direction. Okay. So, we define our cell radius to be the distance to the corner. We're going again to an edge, not to the corner, as we do our movements. we define d to be the distance to the edge, but just geometrically, d can be expressed in terms of r, so the square root of 3 over 2r. Okay. So, again, now we have a little geometry problem. If we want to define the distance between any two centers, we can do it in terms of, I think I actually need to go back a slide. Okay. Yeah, sorry. Okay, so we can do it in terms of the distance they're traversing in either direction. So the change in u gives you for each cell you traverse, you go 2d. And again, in the for each cell you traverse, you go 2d distance. So that gives you your distance u1 minus u2 times square root of 3r, or v1 minus v2 times square root of 3r. Okay. And so if we look what that has given us, we have a distance in the u direction and a distance in the v direction. And what we really want is, again, this direct distance. But again, this is it's just a geometry problem. Okay, so if you like sort of looking at things in a constructive way, you can turn this into a right angle triangle by projecting the V2 contribution onto the y and the x axis. So you have in the x direction v2, the v2 distance times cosine pi over 6. In the y direction, you have to add the u direction plus a component of the v direction. Okay. That gives you your nice right angle triangle. U squared, d is d squared, this is going to be the square root of both sides. And so we let I be u2 minus u1 and j be u2 minus u1. So this is the number of cells we're traversing in either direction. And if we work through, we end up getting our distance squared in terms of r squared, and then the number of cells we're traversing in either direction. Okay. So we've managed to, again, get our reuse distance in terms of our cell size. What that allows us to do, again, is to turn this into a geometry problem. Okay. So we decide, we ask if we're given a minimum reuse distance, then we can decide the size of our cell clusters, begin geometrically. Okay. The size of the cell cluster is referred to as the reuse factor. Okay. And so, again, this is the seven examples of difference. Here's a reuse factor 7, 4, 3. The point here being that you can't have any reuse for hexagonal cells. You can't have any reuse factor, but it has to, again, the clusters have to tessellate, the clusters have to be regular in shape as well. Okay. Okay. So again, what we're faced with really is just a geometry problem. So here we have a diamond shape, and so any cluster is going to be able to form. It's got to have it's going to be square, so you're going to have k cells in either direction, and so we're going to use we're going to have k squared cells in the cluster. The cluster is going to be separated by two k r. So again, you can see this for any. Centers with the same channel allocation, they've got to be k cells away, and each cell will contribute a distance of r. Okay. And so using this, we put together our two equations and this case here, and we solve here for k. We get k is b over 2r, we get n is b over r squared divided by 4. So, in other words, if we know what our requirement is on b relative to r, then we know what size n has to be. Okay, so we can do that. A similar thing for hexagonal cells. Here we look at the relative areas. The area of the cell is given by 3 over 2 square root of 3 all squared. We assume that our clusters now are also hexagonal, and with a radius now of d. And so their area is square root of 3 square root of 2. The number of cells per cluster obviously is given by finding the area of the cluster of the area of the cells. We plug in and get the values as square root of space root of j. Now, any number, but it has to, you have to be able to pick I's and J's to produce that N. Okay.
Susan?
Yes?
N, would N always be a number?
Yeah. No, you'd want to, N has to be a whole number because it's the number of cells. It's, you know, they're distinct units. You can't have half a cell, okay? And so you'd want to round up then. So if you get, you know, well, actually, I and J are integer numbers, so you won't get up. The rounding won't be involved. Okay, so again, this isn't terribly exciting. Just again, if we've picked N and with a specific I and J, that will also tell us how we assign our channels. Again, if it starts with a single channel assignment C1, you would just move I cells in any direction, and then J cells in the opposite direction. Okay, and you keep repeating that for as long as you need to make channel assignments. Okay, so here we see to assign C1 with I is 3, and you move 3 cells in N directions. So 6 possibilities, and then 2 cells in the clockwise direction. Okay. So again, what we saw was important in coming up with this. System was not the absolute value of B, so not the absolute distance, but the distance relative to the cell size. And you know, you can just think about it, if the cell gets bigger, you know, D will be increasing at the same rate. So the ratio of D over R is the co-channel interference inducing factor. And so the larger D is relative to R, the less interference. And that ought to make sense. Again, because you're the larger or fixed R, the farther away D is getting. Yeah, that's be less interference. So again, you either are moving the cells farther apart or just making the cell radius smaller. To be honest, you have to do both at the same time, or relative to each other. Okay. So, again, if we look at area, again, this is an example of P over R is 4. So we have 4 cells per cluster. And you can cover a greater physical area, again, just by increasing the radius of the cells. The ratio of the cell radius to the overall distance is If we increase V over R, again, if we look at it relative to our first cluster, we're keeping the cell radius the same relative to the first picture, but we're requiring them that the cells be twice as far away. And so that means that our cell clusters are going to have to take in more cells, twice the number of cells, four times the number of cells, 2 squared. And so down there, we've reduced the co-channel interference, but at the price of having to split up our channels into smaller pieces to allocate to the cells, to the individual cells in the cluster. So, again, the final piece of the puzzle then is, we've seen that the ratio of reuse distance to cell radius is what's governing the topology of our system. The ratio of the reuse distance to cell radius is what's important in determining the signal to interference ratio. So, for any given cell, the lowest power is at the edge, so the signal power is dropped by R to minus gamma, or some gamma. The interference is governed by the distance between cells sharing channels, and again, that power is dropping.
Power minus gamma. Okay.
So, if you look at this example, you see that there's lots of cells using the same channels and therefore contributing in some way to the interference. Now we observe that with the way the power drops exponentially, it's really only adjacent cells and adjacent clusters that are going to in any way substantially contribute to the interference. So we just look at the contributions from adjacent clusters. If we have our hexagonal arrangement, there are going to be 6 of these adjacent clusters. They're all going to be equidistant from the cell we're concerned with. And therefore, we get our signal to interference ratio is V over R to gamma, divided by however many cells we have. Or,
we can look at that and part of the slide.
Sorry, okay. So we also said that D over R was related to the, you know, just geometrically, to the reuse factor. So we can use that to get a relation between the signal interference ratio and the reuse factor. And so then again, our reuse factor becomes a function of our signal interference ratio. Okay. So that's sort of the final piece of the puzzle where we want it to be. You give me a signal to interference ratio. I tell you how you have to lay out your cells. Okay. Now, that means that each cluster is going to have a certain number of cells in it. And again, our system has been divided into a certain fixed number of channels, and that those numbers of channels have to be divided up amongst the cells in the cluster. Okay. And so this means that the capacity is not a great word, but the number of channels per cell, and therefore the channel density, if you will, is governed by our signal to interference ratio. Okay. So to look at a simple example, we have a gamma of 2 here, and so we're given a certain signal to interference ratio in decibels. And we ask essentially how many channels does each individual cell get? Okay. Given our signal to interference ratio, we get a reuse factor, sort of unfortunately here, it doesn't matter if it's dB or not, 10 dB is 10. So we reduce factor 20. We need to define a cluster that respects by n pi squared plus j squared plus I out of j. And so the best one we can get there is 21. And so the overall number of channels is the overall bandwidth divided by the bandwidth of each channel is 200, so you get each cell gets 200 over 21 channels for its use. Okay. Okay. So again, it's this geometric exercise to arrive at that with again. Final portion being to observe how the signal interference ratio is a function of the cell radius to reuse distance. As I said, I'll just mention CDMA systems. For CDMA systems, again, our signal to interference ratio is obviously the power of the transmitted signal relative to the power of the interfering signals. And interference is going to happen within the cell and within adjacent cells. And it's also going to be dependent on the encoding. So if you had completely orthogonal encoding, you would have no interference. If your encoding is not perfectly orthogonal, you will have interference. Okay. determine how many channels we can have. Again, this is determined by our approach interference we're going to encounter. And that's also, that's in turn, a function of how well we're balancing the power between the cell. We mentioned earlier that CDMA needs to balance out the power of the cell. So if we assume that we can balance things perfectly, then we can sort of find the power ratio and then number of channels against function of this power ratio and our signal to interference ratio. Okay. So yeah, it's a lot more complicated for the CDMA case. Okay, well, we'll just finish off this portion of lecture, just mentioning power control. Again, the issue here is that the received power of a signal is going to depend where within a cell the mobile unit actually is. And so the transmit level is going to have to change. And again, depending on the nature of the communication and what we can do, differs. So the uplink is from the mobile unit to the base station, and so you should be able to change the level as needed. The downlink is going to be from the base station to possibly multiple mobile units. So again, you're limited in sort of what power control you can do, depending if you're sending to a specific unit or to all units. Again, you want your power to be enough to deal with noise. You have to not minimize them, then at least cap your power output so that you're not interfering with other, so you're not producing more than an absolute amount of per-channel interference. Okay. And as we said before, with CDMA, the received power of different signals ought to be level, or else one signal is going to interfere unduly with another. Okay. So we can do either open loop or closed loop power control. With open loop power control, the mobile unit is going to adjust its transmit level based on the received signal on control channels, and we use a channel inversion technique, so the weaker the received signal, the stronger and the higher the level it will transmit at. Okay, so in that way, hopefully at the base station, the signals are received at the same power level. Closed loop power control relies on sort of feedback from the mobile unit, and here the base station can also alter its power, its transmit power, depending on what information it receives. So, we said this before, it's particularly important to CDMA systems that all signals be received at the base station at the same power level. And so, the farther out you are from the base station, the relatively greater power you have to transmit. So, again, it's complicated to actually be able to properly balance out the different power levels. Okay. So, I'll stop there, take a break, our usual 15-minute break. When we come back, the main topic will be traffic engineering. So we've allocated all our channels, and so the question becomes, well, how many users can you support within that cell? Okay, so if you have 5 channels, you can support 5 active users, obviously, but if you assume that users aren't always connected, then you can support more users within the system. So we'll leave it there, take a 15-minute break, and then return to that idea.